Hi, I'm Nicole Ferraro, and this is The Divide, a podcast from Light Reading exploring the ongoing digital divide, why and where it still exists, and what needs to be done to get people everywhere connected to reliable, high-speed internet. Today, I am joined by Jonathan Chambers, partner at Connexon, which is a company that works with electric cooperatives to build and operate fiber networks. We discuss the progress that Connexon has made over the last several years building fiber networks in the rural U.S. We also talk about his concerns about the federal government's Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program, or BEAD, as well as his ideas for how to preserve the Affordable Connectivity Program through the Lifeline benefit and much more. Jonathan, welcome back to the podcast. It's great to see you. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Nicole. It's always good to see you. Always good to read your columns.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And I am a fellow admirer because I read your newsletters every Friday. They are excellent. They are succinct and inspiring. So I really recommend that everybody subscribes to them, the Co-ops Connect newsletter from Connexon. So
very kind of you. Thank you.
Absolutely mean it.
admiration piece.
Fair enough. Yes, because we have a lot more to get to today. We're going to talk a lot about the federal broadband programs, but first, I want to talk a bit about Connexon. And for anyone who might be listening and is unfamiliar with you guys, I would love for you to give just a brief explanation of your business. But let's also talk about your progress. You actually put out a newsletter today talking about your milestones. So give us a bit of the backstory on Connexon, and then tell us a bit about how far you've come in the last few years, I guess, or the last even year change.
Yeah, thanks very much. We've been around 8.5 years now. So not the oldest company, but also not any longer the newest. Started with one specific objective, and we have tried to keep to our knitting throughout. And that objective was to work with rural electric cooperatives in areas of the country that are poorly served with broadband, to work with those cooperatives to build and, if they need it, to help operate fiber optic network, internet access networks that are integrated into the electric utility so that they are usable, the networks themselves, are usable for smart grid, for the management of electric networks. The company was founded by my business partner, a fellow named Randy Clint, who built what became the first full system fiber optic network built to every member of an electric cooperative. And he did so without any government grants or subsidies. And he did so at a time, this was starting in 2011, at a time when most of the federal regulators and policymakers and industry believed that building in rural America was too expensive. And so rather than constructing networks that were equivalent to comparable to networks that were built in urban and suburban areas, that is to say, cable and fiber optic networks, that the government was turning to alternatives, slower speeds, less capacity, second and third best alternatives. And what Randy was able to demonstrate at that network in central Missouri, the co-op was called Como Electric, the network was called Como Connect. What he was able to demonstrate was that if you paid attention to the pennies, if you were careful about how you designed, constructed, if you leveraged some of the infrastructure that has been in place for decades in the electric cooperative distribution networks, you could in fact build a fiber optic network. He launched gigabit service in central Missouri just a few months after Google Fiber launched gigabit service in Kansas City, some miles to the west of where he was. That demonstration made a profound difference in some parts of the country. It got to my attention when I was at the Federal Communications Commission, as well as the attention of some of my colleagues. I left the FCC in 2016 in order to join Randy and to do what he had done in Central Missouri, to work with him, to encourage work with electric cooperatives, to try to replicate that feat of you can build a fiber optic network everywhere you've got electric line. So in our terminology, you know, fiber follows power. And if you do so and follow the other principles of electric co-ops, which are that every member is part of one overall unit, that is, we're all in this together, then you can build a network so that everyone has service. And that has been our guiding principle since the beginning. When we work with electric co-ops, we tell them upfront that our objectives are to build to every single member of the electric cooperative. Second, that's first and foremost, and that is a hard and fast objective. Second, that none of the electric co-op electric business will be used to subsidize the fiber business. These co-ops are lightly regulated, sometimes more heavily than others. It's a state regulation question. But in no case does the electric co-op want its electric-only members to subsidize the internet access of others of its members. And our third principle is simply to build fast. These are large geographic areas, thousands of miles of electric distribution network. And to build fast for us means really one thing. People have waited long enough. Areas that are unserved and underserved have already suffered from the lack of service, suffered during COVID, suffered due to lack of economic development. And so if you show up at an electric co-op that is, say, 4 to 6,000 miles of line, and the average electric co-op is 3 to 4,000 miles of electric distribution line. But if you were to say, we're going to build your network, and over the next 10 or 12 or 15 years, we will get the job done, you might as well say, it's forever. Yeah. And so we've developed certain construction techniques, certain design techniques, developed our own fiber optic cable, done certain things that allow us to build more rapidly than has been the norm. So that if we come to a 6,000 mile electric co-op, we're looking to build that network between 4 and 5 years, a 2,000 mile network to build within a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And what I wrote about in the column that you mentioned was that since these are large projects and they do take years, they're multi-year projects, we've started to get to the point where we're completing projects. And completion to us means you make access, internet access available to 100% of the members of the cooperative. Mm-hmm. We've completed, in that sense, over 20 projects to date. And this year, we're getting to the point where we're completing projects that we began in 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021. So this year, we will complete another 20 or so electric co-op projects.
Wow.
Now, they're never complete in this other sense. There are always new electric lines built and therefore fiber lines. Mm-hmm. Most, if not all, of the electric cooperatives we work with will be encouraged to build outside their electric service territory because neighboring communities will recognize what was done there.
Yeah.
So there's always some build, but for us, complete really means we did what we set out to do, which was to make sure that the entirety of the membership of the electric cooperative benefits from the network, has access to the service. That to us. So we will at some point this year, I expect, start our 100th project. There are over 800 electric distribution co-ops in the country. Mm-hmm. So by no means are we building everywhere, but we're getting to the point where with the projects we have, we'll build 10, maybe 15% of the entirety of the geography of the country, not the population. I always stress where we build, you know, there's a lot of dirt between light bulbs. So you measure things in miles, you measure things in geography, you don't measure things necessarily in terms of houses or businesses. And my own personal goal has always been to get to 20, maybe 25% of the country in terms of fiber optic access with work that we and our partners have done. I think if we do that, it will have this other effect, which is it will be expected and not just where we're working, of course, but where everybody's working. And we'll finally get to the point that the country got to in the 30s and 40s with electricity, where it's expected that you get access to the best service available, or at least the same service that's available elsewhere.
I love it. Very exciting and really incredible work. You mentioned a little bit that's different about your process that allows you guys to, you know, complete these builds, I guess, ahead of others, perhaps. I'm wondering, is there anything else about the way that you're hiring contractors or, you know, acquiring supplies or anything else that's helping you guys stay ahead of some of the other challenges that other providers are facing? And are you worried, you know, we're going to get to BEAD in a little bit. We'll get to it in more detail. But do you worry about, as those builds ramp up, about that putting more pressure on the areas that you're building out in?
If I thought BEAD was going to be a large success, I would be concerned about shortages of labor, particular kinds of labor. It's not labor writ large, but say the make-ready construction labor, changing out that which is used to change out poles or do other work on poles to make them ready for the strand and the fiber. I don't think BEAD is going to, let me be less subjective, or at least use a word, I don't mean success. I don't think it's going to lead to a lot of construction, whereas it's lots and lots of miles. So I don't think BEAD is going to affect, at least it won't affect our supply chain. We anticipated what we were going to do years ago. So we ramped up to have that capacity. And what I mean specifically is we knew we were going to bid in the Rural Digital Opportunity Fund auction, the RDOF auction. We knew that because we had been the largest winning bidder at the gigabit tier in the Connect America Fund 2 auction. And so that auction was in 2018. The RDOF auction was planned for 2020. At the beginning of 2020, we went to all of our vendors, the material suppliers, fiber manufacturers, electronics manufacturers, mainline fiber crews. We mostly build aerial, so, you know, mainline fiber crews that need bucket trucks, insulated buckets. We went to them and told them that we anticipated at that time increasing our build from about 25,000 miles, which we had done the previous year, to closer to 50,000 miles. Mm-hmm. And we were going to need to do so the year after the RDOF auction. So we had everyone ramp up their capacity in plenty of time. And then in 2021, the year after the auction was held, even though nobody was getting RDOF money yet, we did build around 50,000 miles, and we did so the following year too. So we were able to meet the expectation we had set, and that meant that the production lines had been built for us in anticipation. The crews that we had working were all, again, ready in anticipation of what we were doing. In 2020, we bought a small splicing company, set up a splicing school in northern Georgia, and began training splicers. We trained about 150 splicers over the course of that first year after we set the school up. So we did all that expecting we would build a lot of miles, and then did build a lot of miles. What we're doing now is, like, no secret. We're still building the RDOF markets. And so as things roll into BEAD, as we roll off the the networks that we started, the ones that I mentioned that will complete this year, we have the capacity from those to move them to other geographies, to other projects, to new projects. I don't think we're going to necessarily increase what we do as much as move our build capacity from some markets to other markets. And as I said, I don't think BEAD is going to be lots and lots of new miles built.
Right.
Not in our world. I mean, in our world, lots of miles would mean, you know, are there going to be hundreds of thousands of new miles built? No. Might there be tens of thousands? It's possible. But that doesn't affect us.
Okay. So, all right, let's just stick with BEAD then, since we've touched on it. And I'm sensing some skepticism from you about the program. And I want to reference something you wrote in your newsletter a couple of weeks ago, which was you described the BEAD program as a politician's idea of a solution for rural broadband and that it won't ultimately close the digital divide. My reading of your newsletter, I could be wrong, was you taking issue with the extremely high cost threshold that allows for non-fiber technologies to be used. That was just my understanding of what you were maybe pointing to as one of the issues with the program. But rather than my understanding, I would love to hear what your actual feelings are about why BEAD is a politician's idea of a digital divide program.
So I was describing something that has a lot more to do with the past 10 to 15 years worth of federal funding of rural broadband, and don't see BEAD as anything fundamentally different than what's gone on in the past. So that's really my reference to a politician's idea of a solution.
Okay.
In 2010, the FCC, I started working there in 2012, but in 2010, the FCC set out as broadband, a definition for broadband, 4 megabits per second downstream, 1 megabit per second upstream. It was some people's idea of broadband, but it wasn't what was widely available across the country. It wasn't what cable was capable of producing. It was a technological limitation, a capacity limitation of a particular type of broadband service, which was DSL service at a certain distance between the DSLAM and an endpoint. So I say that because from then until today, you will hear politicians use a phrase of technological neutrality. It is Orwellian. Technological neutrality is used in order to ensure that the least capable technologies qualify for broadband. It's not neutrality in the sense that somebody sat down and defined what would be needed in today's world, next year's world, 10 years from now, year's world, or the life of these networks, 30 years from now's world. And so what the FCC did, it wasn't about defining speeds. It was about then spending money in the areas that were determined to need the money because they lacked that particular speed. Mm-hmm. So the FCC spent money, and by money, I don't mean, you know, $1.50. I mean billions and then tens of billions of dollars, chasing first 4 megabits per second down, one up, then 10 down, one up, and 25 down, three up, and now 100 down, 20 up. Hey, guess what? The same places that got upgraded to 4.1, well, then the government had to spend money to get them to 10.1. Those same places, the parts of the first Connect America Fund programs, we had to spend money in those places to bring them up to 25.3. Those same places, that's what's eligible. That was what was eligible for RDOF. Those same places then became eligible for BEAD if they were 25.3, but not 100 down, 20 up. If you keep spending money in the same place over and over again, that's what I mean. You're dependent in perpetuity upon government's largesse. You get, as a politician, you get to make this big announcement that you're spending money. You're not solving a problem, but you're spending money. Obviously, my view is make a plan to build so that you, the long-term solve of the digital divide is that the areas that are on the wrong side of the divide get the same technology access transmission medium that's available in the rest of the country. Mm-hmm. That closes the divide. Today, you want the government's about to spend money and has been spending money on 100 down, 20 up. Yeah. 100 down, 20 up is no longer broadband. I don't care that the FCC just announced, because that report that the FCC has to issue every year is not really used by technologists or economists or anybody else or business people to define what they're going to spend their money on. 4.1 wasn't broadband, and yet the government spent money on 4.1. 10.1 wasn't broadband even at the time. Mm-hmm. 25.3 wasn't broadband even at the time the money was spent. And I'm telling you for certainty that at the time, if people spend their money on 100 down, 20 up, by the time these networks mature, before the money is spent, that won't be considered broadband, because it isn't considered broadband today. We don't offer a service that slow. We don't offer in rural America a service that slow. Our best-selling service, 2 gigabits per second down, 2 gigabits per second up. In rural America, in the poorest parts of the country, mm-hmm. It isn't what people want.
Right.
That's my complaint about the BEAD program, the RDOF program before it, the CAF programs before it, the ARPA programs, the CARES Act programs. There's lots and lots of programs. BEAD is $42.45 billion for rural America. Mm-hmm. It isn't the first time we spent $40 billion. It's the second or third time we will have spent $40 billion in rural America. And we didn't solve the problem, not once, and this won't solve the problem either, because the goal is wrong.
Uh-huh. So you know how these things get put together. You worked within the government. Keeping reality in mind, what would you have done differently with this program?
I worked in government. I worked on Capitol Hill. I was the Republican staff director of the Senate Commerce Committee that drafted a lot of the legislation that still exists today. Mm-hmm. I would point to one aspect of the legislation that was drafted and then adopted in 1996, the 96 Telecom Act, having to do with universal service. Mm-hmm. The words contain a weaselly lawyer word, which is reasonably, but in Section 254 of the Telecommunications Act, 1996, the government set out a standard for rural America and set out a standard for that matter for low-income Americans, which is they should have access to services, telecommunications and information services, that are reasonably comparable to the services available to urban Americans, to urban households. You can't tell me that 4.1 is reasonably comparable to, at the time, the standard in urban America, which was 100 megabits per second down. You can't tell me today that 100 down, 20 up is reasonably comparable to the 2 gig symmetrical service or the multi-gig symmetrical service that we and everybody else sells today. So at a minimum, why put in place a number, which Congress did in the Infrastructure Act, mm-hmm. a number which is out of date by the time the ink is dry?
Right.
One could have used a standard reasonably comparable. I'd have gotten rid of the word reasonably. That would have been my entire legislative effort. I wrote about this years ago. Said if you want to fix the government programs for rural America, just get rid of the word reasonably and have the ability of somebody to hold the FCC or other agencies that are given the mandate to spend the public's money to say that the service has to be comparable. Now, I'd go one step further, because that 96 Act talks about reasonably comparable to services available today, but you're spending money on networks that are meant to last for decades.
Yeah.
So I would at least, I don't know, gather a group of technologists, maybe the Internet Institute, and say, What do you expect to be the standard 10 years from now? You don't have to put on your, you know, futuristic hat. You don't have to ask AI, you know, just what do you think will be available in 10 years, given that from 10 years ago to today, we've changed the measurement, you know, by tenfold, 50-fold, 100-fold. Nobody in 2010 would have believed me had I said, you know what, by 2024, I'm going to be running a business in rural areas and I'm going to be selling mostly 2 gigabit per second symmetrical service, and that's what people will buy. They would have thought I was crazy. So 10 years from now, no, it's not even going to be 2 gigabits per second. So why fund businesses that are building networks that can do 100 down, 20 up? We know what the technologies are that are capable of delivering multi-gigabit services. If I have to say it to people in the cable industry and the wireless industry, yes, I mean, fiber optic networks are the best investment of public and private money. That's what the public should be investing its money in. The public should not invest its money in bad bets. Yeah. You're going to invest your money in bad bets over and over again because people are using standards that are out of date before the appropriations passes Congress and assigned by the president. And yeah, you shouldn't be in the business of writing that legislation.
So I'm going to stick with this.
And I was there. I was in Congress. I was at the FCC. I've been in this industry for 30 now, going over 30 years. I'm an old man still in a hurry. It doesn't mean people can't reach the right decision just because Congress is the way it is. And when we get to talking about ACP, I'll say, but you have to take into account Congress being the way it is. You're asking Congress for money.
Oh, I completely agree with that. That's why I've been angry about the ACP issue since this particular Congress was elected, because it seemed to me that there was no chance of getting the extension passed once that happened. And everyone else seemed to be pretending we were living in some fantasy world. But just to stick with what you were talking about for 1 second, and then I will get to the ACP and then I will set you free. If you were still at the Senate Commerce Committee on the Republican side, your views would be a little bit out of step, because most of the push to keep BEAD tech neutral has been coming from Senate Republicans. And I'm just wondering if you have any understanding of what that's about, given, you know, so many of them do represent rural areas.
Nobody's ever explained it to them.
Okay. You need to then just call them up, I guess. And this
no, look, helped. Again, I work there. I don't lobby. When you work in those places, you have an understanding that's about an inch deep. And you get lobbied by people who have an understanding that's about 2 inches deep.
Yeah.
I'm embarrassed when I think back of my knowledge back in the late 80s or early 90s when I was drafting legislation or working with people in crafting legislation, at how little I knew. I think it can be explained, and I think we can do better. Maybe not with this particular Congress. It's been pretty dysfunctional. But I never rule out that people can come to the right decision once things are presented to them. I'm not going back. That is, I'm not going back in time thinking, well, had I been there, or had I advocated for a certain thing, or somebody would have changed their mind. I'm not that persuasive. Trust me, I am self-aware enough, which is why I work for myself. I've been fired from lots of jobs. I can't, you know, I'm not going to be fired from a job from a company I started with my partner. No, I think the best solution for us is demonstration, is proving what can be done, is getting local communities to recognize that what can be done. I wouldn't, by the way, try to get people to change standards, but I would give power the power of the purse, I'd have that waterfall its way down until you get to the lower and lower levels. If a local, I haven't met a local community yet who says, you know what we'd really like? We'd like the carrier pigeons and toucans and string. That seems like a good technology to us. They don't.
Yeah.
People want the best for their community and they're tired of getting the second best. I was at a conference last year at some point and a young woman in the marketing division of an electric co-op was talking about the services they were providing, and her mother was buying internet access and her mother wanted gigabit service. And the way she told the story, she said, Mom, you don't need gigabit access. You don't do all of the things you need. And she said, I want gigabit. She said, no, you could get by with 100 megabit service. It's good enough for what you need. And she said, my mom looked at me and said, you know, my whole life I've been going with second best. I want the best. End of discussion.
Yep.
So I think people can be convinced, but it's easier to convince people at a local level.
Yeah.
So let the money flow downhill from the federal government allocated to the states. If the states allocated to the counties, maybe you'd get better outcomes.
All right. Excellent. Let's close out now with the Affordable Connectivity Program, the ACP. When this episode runs, it's going to be about mid-April. And so we'll be pretty close to the ACP running out of funding completely by the end of May. There has been hope for Congress to fund it, but those hopes are pretty much running out. So you had filed a petition with the FCC, basically asking them to start a proceeding. I might not be using the right terminology, but essentially to roll the ACP into the Lifeline program by changing the parameters of Lifeline a bit. And this is basically something the FCC could do really, my understanding is, in enough time to not let the ACP end if they were to actually take steps to do it.
Yes.
So a few questions on that. One, feel free to explain better than I just did what you're proposing. Two, how important are Lifeline and the ACP to Connexon? And three, what's your thought, short thought on universal service reform, how to keep that fund actually going?
So what I proposed, and I did ask the FCC to put this petition out for comment under an expedited proceeding. That is what they did recently, and we're in the midst of in the so limited amnesty for RDOF defaults,
yes,
which is the FCC can have a comment and reply period that are varying lengths. They can have 2 months for comments and a month for replies, for example. So in the this very recent current, I'm confusing myself because you said this will publish in April. So by then the replies will be over. But at the time I'm talking, comments, I think, are due today.
And you're talking about the RDOF thing, right?
Yeah, there's an RDOF proceeding.
Yes, the comments were due on the RDOF thing earlier this week, and then the reply comments are due in April, which will be the month that this podcast runs.
Right.
So you're proceeding.
That's an expedited.
Yeah.
That's an expedited proceeding in the sense that the FCC can issue an order after reply comments are in and they have a record.
Mm-hmm.
So when they want to hurry things up, they shorten the time periods. They'll say, okay, you can comment within 2 weeks, 2 weeks from the date of the issuance of the FCC's whatever it wants to publish, public notice. And then a week after that, you have replies. They've done something like that here. That's what I was asking them to do with Lifeline and ACP for one reason, which is to get ahead of ACP running out of money. And what I suggested that the FCC could do within that time period was really make one or two adjustments to the current Lifeline program. So I didn't mean let's reform Lifeline and let's come up with a new scheme. No, Lifeline has been around in one form or another since 1984. It's a 40-year-old program. I was suggesting that they take the current amount of $9.25 and increase that to the ACP amount for those low-income households that qualify for Lifeline. So go from 925 to 30. And I suggested that they could do so before, again, before the time period runs out for ACP. I did not propose that they change the eligibility criteria for households for Lifeline, which is currently 135% of the poverty level. ACP is 200%. So I said in the petition, I said in my writings, that I recognize that not everybody who is a recipient of ACP would qualify. They would have to be Lifeline. My rationale for doing it that way is that 135% of the poverty line, those households need the money more. Mm-hmm. I'm not making the economic judgment as to what line to draw. Mm-hmm. I'm saying to do this quickly, you can use the universe of Lifeline and say, increase that to $30.
Right.
If the FCC wants to choose a different percentage, they can. 150, 200. What I'd suggest they should do, and I think I said this too, was they now have a lot of data on the ACP program. They could use that data. I think they should make the data public, not names and addresses, but they could make the data public to see what kind of use was there, what were people subscribing to, how many households at different income levels were subscribing, and do that to refine Lifeline in a further notice of proposed rulemaking after they issue an order on this small Lifeline reform. And then I said one other thing, which is going to be controversial or at least contested, and that is I believe ACP should be viewed in the context of the statute that where it was adopted by Congress, which was an infrastructure statute. Mm-hmm. And the sections it was in that statute were all about what? Building broadband networks. ACP is a mobile program. The majority of the money goes to mobile services. I didn't hear anybody over the last whatever number of years say, you know, the problem with mobile services, there needs to be a $30 subsidy. So when you wonder how it was that $14 billion got spent in a minute and a half, you should recognize that part of the reason was the money went to people who had existing mobile services, who were already spending their money on mobile services, and they didn't need it. ACP was supposed to help improve the economic case for companies to build better networks in rural areas and in urban areas by reaching those who couldn't otherwise afford broadband services. So right. My point in my petition is two things: increase to 30 and limit the increase. Keep Lifeline as it is. Lifeline goes to mobile, but limit the increase to residential broadband. Just that, residential low-income broadband. And then for the rest of it, well, the FCC can start a proceeding. If Congress decides to fund ACP for another 6 months or 8 months or whatever you can do with $6 or $7 billion, that doesn't obviate the need for this petition and this action, because then you'll just run out of money again. And at the time you run out of money, oh my goodness, it'll be just after a national election with a potential change in the Senate and change in the House and potential change in the presidency. And that's when you want to run out of money? I mean, who thought of that? Mm. So you'd still need this proceeding I'm talking about. You just have a little bit more runway to get there. Yeah. One way or the other. And the reason to limit in the way I'm talking about is Lifeline can't be a $10, $12 billion annual program. Mm-hmm. It would bust the FCC's budget. The FCC collects money from telecommunications carriers providing interstate and international services. And the entirety of that revenue base is these days like 30 some billion dollars. So you can't collect 20 billion because there are other programs too in universal service. You can't collect 20 billion off a $30 billion base. You've got to keep the Lifeline program at that billion, maybe $2 billion level, maybe $3 billion, the FCC ought to be able to start reducing the monies that it spends on, guess what, on high-cost fund, because the high-cost fund should be largely addressed through the BEAD program. Right. And so there should be some room to grow Lifeline, but not grow it without analysis, without a recognition that you can't just bust the budget, and with mostly one objective overarching over all others, which is help those people in need, the people most in need right now. Don't try to say like, hey, the best thing about BEAD is we had 23 million households subscribing. That to me isn't a good number, 23 million. That's a budget busting number. You don't want that. You want to help people in need. I'm not saying everybody who received BEAD wasn't in need. I am saying we don't have the money to do that through the Lifeline program. Somebody else can convince Congress to have a steady appropriations for BEAD of $12 billion a year, and, you know, great, knock yourselves out. That isn't what I think is achievable. So, you know, I live in the real world. Yeah. I live in the political world.
Yeah. I think a lot of people agree that ACP and Lifeline need to combine in some way, shape, or form, even ultimately. But a lot of people are also pointing to contribution reform through broadband service revenues, as well as through big tech. Do you have an opinion on either of those?
Sure. As a payor into the system for every company I've ever worked for, sure, would I prefer contribution reform? But I've been, you know, in discussions with people about contribution reform since my hair was brown. The contribution reform is a slow-moving vehicle that may never get to its destination. My point about Lifeline is don't put people who are in need behind contribution reform because they'll never get there. And I recognize what will happen with contribution reform in Congress, because it'll take an act of Congress if you want to change the FCC's authority from collection from providers of telecommunication services to the big, like, what's the big idea? Oh, like, Google's got a lot of money. Let's get them. Oh, Facebook's got a lot of money. Let's get some from them. Once you change the FCC's authority, you're going to get all these arguments in Congress. And I don't know many people in Congress who want to give the FCC not the blank check, like checkbook with lots of blank checks to write. They don't want to do it where they move from a contribution base, the current one of $30 billion, to the potential of a trillion or whatever everybody else's revenues are. So I think it's going to be really hard to pass. Mm-hmm. And not based on, this is my view sitting here today, based on a couple of decades of hearing these arguments.
Yeah.
So sure, great, reform contribution, reform universal service, but don't let everything else wait for that.
Okay. I think that is a great place to leave it, even though I could force you to sit here and talk to me for another 3 hours. But I really appreciate all of your time and insights and the great work you're doing out there. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Nicole. As always, I appreciate you.
Thank you. Thank you again, Jonathan, for joining me. Thank you as well to our producer, Pierre Landriau, for making this episode. Be sure to subscribe to the Light Reading Podcast for more episodes of The Divide, as well as interviews and insights from the Light Reading team. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.